Hi everyone, it's Brian here from Dads with Swords. Just want to apologize, really, that it's been so long since you've heard anything from us. Our schedules have been notoriously hard to get together this last little while. We've never seemed to be all together in the same place at the same time and ready to record a podcast. So hopefully that's going to change soon. I think what we're going to be doing a little bit more of in the future is probably some episodes that are just going to be Krista and I, or just Brant and I, or maybe just Brant and Krista, just depending on how everyone's schedules work out. And we'll try to get the whole crew together, I don't know, once a month or once every 2 months, whatever it turns out we can manage until our schedules get a little bit more in sync again. Hopefully that'll be happening soon. But in any regard, this is actually a pretty old episode. This is one we recorded back in, I think, October. Probably, yeah, mid-October. We sat down at one of the Ironwood Sword School's cutting events. We had a chance to sit down with a wonderful guy by the name of Aaron Miedema. And he's got some interesting credentials and a really interesting history, I guess, in his pursuit of historic European martial arts. So I'm going to let him do the rest of the talking, really, other than a few interjections from Brant and I. I'll again apologize for the lack of content recently, and we'll aim to correct that. We've got a few things that we recorded and files were unfortunately lost on an old phone that broke down on me. So hopefully we'll be able to re-record some of those as well, and we'll try to bring you a little chat with our stick fighting instructor, Maxime Chouinard, soon. But for now, here is the wonderful Aaron Miedema.
Dads with Swords!
It's surely illegal!
Dads with Swords! Dads with Swords!
It just shouldn't happen!
Dads with Swords!
Oh, that's alright.
We may do it outside.
Yeah, well, it'll be fun background noise.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's Brian and Brand here today, and we are joined by another guest this week, and we're not going to try to pronounce his name. We're going to let him do it himself.
Aaron Miedema.
Oh, I was going to say Aaron. So I was way wrong.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Good thing I didn't.
Most people get the last name wrong.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah. So Aaron, I've met you years ago through the SCA, the Society for Creative Anachronism, somewhat briefly and not really formally, I guess. And then somewhat formally, I don't know.
It's you around. It's not formal when it's me.
Fair enough. And then I guess got to know you again now that I'm training here with Ironwood. What is your... where did you get started with HEMA, with historical martial arts, really?
It's kind of a long, twisted story, because I come to it through stage combat, actually.
Oh, really?
So I started with a theater degree at York University, and now 25 years later, I'm doing a PhD at York University. So in 25 years, I've come a long way. I've moved two buildings over and one floor up. but I started there, and one of the best courses I took was the National Stage Combat Workshop, which was running its very first year in Canada at Ryerson that year.
Okay.
And it was a half university credit in 2 weeks where you got to learn unarmed combat, quarterstaff, and rapier and dagger.
Oh, cool. Nice.
So I took this and I ran a theater company that did 16th and 17th century plays within their original context of performance, and it's hard to do without swordplay. So
yeah.
I got a lot of practice teaching people how to do stage combat. Then at a certain point, I realized I really am not that fond of actors. So what happened at that point is the theater fell to the side and the fencing kind of stayed. And it was just at that time people were starting to open the old masters. They weren't looking too hard. So
right.
The two that they found were Saviolo and Degrassi,
right.
Which are right there to be found. And so I started trying to merge the two and taking what I'd learned by teaching... technique and what I could glean from the old books. And I started doing historical fencing within the SCA probably in 1997, I would guess.
Okay.
If memory serves. And that kind of took off, and my introduction to HEMA comes, it kind of starts in 2000 when I almost go to the WMA conference that they had in Toronto.
Almost.
I almost went.
Okay.
I was finally given my first paying role in a play. I was still dabbling in theater at that point. And so it's like, oh my God, I can't go. I'm getting paid to act. And it was a paltry sum, and I regretted that decision. Then I had a chance 2 years later to go to the WMA conference in Amsterdam, New York.
Oh, cool.
And so I got introduced to a lot of things here. I got to see Jared Kirby, who had just translated Capoferro, and this is the first big Italian translation of fencing manuals. I got to see Stefan Dieter doing a class on the similarities between Vigiani and Meyer, all sorts of stuff. One of the biggest classes that I got to see there was Gary Chalak teaching the artful play of a fencing master by the name of Nicoletto Giganti.
Okay.
And so at that time, I'm just in Kingston. I'm just working in a restaurant, and I just get laid off when I'm going to go back to school to finish my degree in order to go back to grad school. And so I decide I'm going to start translating Giganti.
Right.
It wasn't that long. It's only like 30 pages of text. How hard could it be? Well, okay, so it took me 12 years to finish. I did my time on unemployment insurance that way. Got kind of the first run of it down. And then I got into Carleton to do a BA in history. And so I was getting all psyched up to do the stuff I had to do there. So I was taking my Italian, I was taking my Latin, I was taking my medieval history, my early modern history, Byzantine history. And it's here that I meet a Canadian military historian by the name of Tim Cook, which takes me on a very strange kind of HEMA path, which I haven't necessarily pursued.
Okay.
I could be described as the world's expert in British imperial bayonet fighting tactics of the First World War. It's when a military historian who I, on a lark, took his class, found out what I did as a hobby, and he said, "Have you thought about bayonet fighting and shock tactics of the First World War for an essay?" And it's like,
now I have.
There's an idea. my academics and my HEMA career are really kind of twisted into each other. Wait, I've gone way farther than how did I begin?
No, that's great. Yeah, that's fine. That's good.
I was actually going to go even further back in time, though, because there's a good question we always ask when people
just,
are
just
interested in swords.
We'll finish that story in a moment. Just leave you hanging. Okay.
What's the first time that you can remember holding a sword, looking at a sword, and just going, "Yeah, that's cool. I want to do that. I want to do something with swords."
It really wasn't about the mystique of the sword with me.
No.
I have the strange OCD.
Right.
And I need to bring order to chaos.
Okay.
And the chaos of, like, what do these old fencing manuals actually say is, like, this OCD thing that I just have to solve.
Okay.
So it's not that any particular romanticism of the sword. I find fencing a lot of fun because it doesn't rely on other people like a theater company. It's something I can do, and it's something that really kind of satisfies my OCD. And by doing this, I'm now like a PhD student studying the duel in the 16th century Italy. And now I'm going to Italy and discovering hitherto thought lost fencing manuals.
Yes.
It wasn't the magic of the sword. It's just doing it that I like.
Awesome. I was actually going to, I didn't want to skip ahead too much, but just following you on Facebook is absolutely fascinating because we're getting the most minute details of you just glossing through these old tomes, these dusty things that you're finding in libraries and saying, what's the one story about the gentleman's shoes?
Oh, that's a brawl that I found in Rome in 1561 that takes place in a little square called the Pace. And the brawl could actually have been a duel, which is how it falls into my dissertation topic. And it's a really interesting case because we have none of the witnesses are the guys who were actually involved.
Right.
They all got scarce and left town. The one guy who lost a finger refuses to tell the notaries anything. So it's left to, like, everyone around there. And if for anyone who's been to Italy, you may have seen this, but for anyone who's going to go to Italy, there's a couple of things you need to know: that people will look at you and then instantly look at your shoes.
Right.
And if you want to be fashionable, wear really nice shoes. If you want to be seen as homeless and not get mugged, wear something really shoddy. So, and this goes back to the 16th century. So in this description of the nameless guy that cuts off his master's finger, he has to make a comment about his dressed leather shoes. It's just so deliciously Italian.
So it's fair to say then, I guess, you focus on Italian martial arts for the most part.
Yes and no. I've dabbled in other places. Sure. I was one of the founding members of what has become Ironwood.
Right.
And that was a discussion that happened in a bar where two people came with German manuals and I came with Fiori, and I didn't really feel like asserting myself. So as a result, I learned a little more about German longsword than I did about Italian longsword.
I feel like the two against one is like a critical component of German longsword. If you can do it, why not, right?
Well, to be fair, Robert came with Talhofer, so we were naturally going to go with Lichtenauer.
Right. So I guess we could go back to... let's go back and finish the story. You're talking about your academic career being somewhat wed to your study of historic martial arts.
Yeah. So when Tim Cook finds out what I do as a specialty, he suggests this, and... I then am applying to take a master's degree in something early modern in Italian. But because I had a previous degree and I could blow through the degree at Carleton in history in 2 years, it meant I didn't have 2 years of good transcripts for my grant applications.
Right.
So I had no money following me. And it was the year that the double cohort finally was going to grad school.
Yeah.
So I had no money, and then on top of that, every single early modern prof in Ontario was going on sabbatical.
Wow.
So in putting in all these applications, I'm in Kingston and on a lark, I decided to drop one off at RMC.
Right.
And it just so happens that Tim was the Wunderkund out of the first year of the war studies program at the Royal Military College, and I'm pretty sure he called somebody and said, somebody has to take this guy.
Yeah.
Regardless, I got accepted to RMC, was planning to do a bit of master's on training, and then that morphed into trench raiding, and then I went to a military history conference and gave the paper that I'd written for him on bayonet fighting for shock and shock tactics, and Tim straddles up to me afterwards and says, "Huh, it sounds like you're already laying out the chapters in your mind. I think this is your thesis." And I go, "Hey, there's an idea." And so... I finished that off, and now I've taken the swing back in my PhD, and I'm working on the duel in 16th century Italy. Of course, when I'm traipsing through these libraries and finding, you know, these obscure little cases and obscure little law books, I'm also taking the opportunity to find, you know, old fencing manuals. So
right.
I've got a few of them in the can after the last trip, and the next trip to Italy, now that I know how to use the Italian library system, because that is a task unto itself, I will go back and I will find more. I already have a list.
Nice.
Great.
So.
Well, that's exciting anyway. Last time you came out to an Ironwood class, you were showing us some sort of, Fiori fundamentals. Like just a couple of little things, and you really started to get into more of the psychology of the fight, I think, than we had seen in classes beforehand. You're really talking about ways to interrupt the thinking of an Italian fencer, or a typical Italian fencer.
We also looked at the way that an Italian would respond to a German approach.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of themes that came out of that one. First off, Germans need to practice wrestling more.
Right.
Because in the close fight, the Italians, they start with wrestling. And so it's far more ingrained in what they're doing. So when the fight gets close, typically the Italian will have more experience. But the other one was the idea that the door opens both ways.
Mm-hmm.
So the Italians are going to go for that opening. And if you see that opening in the same time as a German, you can go through that door just as easily as the Italian can.
Yeah.
So one way to prevent an Italian from closing to wrestle with you is to close and wrestle with him when he opens that door. He'll bind, he'll move the sword out of the way. Both people can go through it.
Right.
So
just, I guess, for us to try to be a little more unexpected in that way.
Just get used to wrestling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how is how's all the PhD research going? You know, how...
So I'm thinking of taking a leave of absence next year, I have no distractions, so I can just sit and work on the dissertation.
Right.
I have several thousand pages of archival data to go through from the archives in Modena. I collected about 115 books that I have to go through and translate, which are written accounts of duels that, well, duels in 16th century Italy would become written in book form. They'd become so significant, and so I was tracking down these books, and I have to go through these and translate them and figure out what's going on.
Right.
And I still have to do the Wealth of Dueling manual. So I've got a lot of grunt work that I have to go through, and it's just, I have to teach class, I have to do this, I have to do paleography, and it's just not enough time in the day.
Yeah, right.
So I'm just a year to take off and do my trip to southern Italy and do that research trip. So I may take it off just to give myself time, but I'm told this is fairly normal.
Okay,
so
that's good.
And then go back for my last year and finish and get everything polished.
So do you find the actual active fencing for you, is it more of just a practical research thing, or do you enjoy the physicality of it and the, you know, the exercise and the practice of fencing?
I enjoy the puzzle of fencing, right? That, you know, that notion of order out of chaos. But I think the most important thing is fencing is a life skill.
Right.
It's not easy, it's hard, and that's why we do it. And the most important thing that fencing teaches you is that when you step onto the field, you have to take all the other crap out of your brain.
Right.
It was a bad day, this is happening, that is happening, it doesn't matter. You got some guy with a sword who's coming at you, and that's the only thing you have to think about. And that ability to clear your mind, I think, is kind of the life skill that fencing gives you.
Right.
So.
Okay. So, I know you do longsword in the Fiore tradition. I've seen you do, sword and buckler. And I've seen you do rapier through the SCA. Is there any weapon forms that you're really fond of that I'm missing? Or is there a favorite in there?
Well, 17th century Italian rapier is my thing.
Yeah.
I translated Gigante. I have a Capoferro translation in the can. And I've started doing Fabrice and potentially working on doing workshops on staging Fabrice, putting it on its feet and seeing how it works. So that's kind of my special place in my heart. But German longsword, I did 6 years with Anyhow, which is the precursor to Ironwood.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did a couple years of Fiori, and I've done some in Academy Duello. Excuse me. And now I'm doing stuff with the Bolognese, or at least starting to. Marazzo, who's the big master of the Bolognese school, a third of his book is on the actual execution of the duel. So I had to go through and translate this anyway.
Yeah.
So I just did the entire book.
Why not?
Well, it takes a lot of time. That may be why not. But he's also an infuriating writer.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, he comes from Bologna, which is a big university town, right?
Okay.
There's a law school. And so he seems to have this big chip on his shoulder.
Right.
To sound erudite. So he'll choose this obscure Italian word to describe something, and he'll use it for 2 pages, and then he'll use another word.
Right.
Right. And he's just trying to show how big his vocabulary is.
Right. Does he get like that Kids in the Hall sketch where the guy learns the word ascertain?
I'm sorry, I never watched Kids in the Hall.
Well, that's all right. I think you do get your Canadian citizenship revoked for that, but...
Well, no comment.
Yeah.
Given the current political climate.
Yeah. Fair enough.
We'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Is there anything, whether it's a specific weapon or just a specific manual that you haven't had a chance to work from and you'd really like to try?
Well, I mean, it's this one that I found in Italy this time around.
Right.
It's a manual by a master by the name of Mercurio Spettioli. And it's not a really huge fencing manual. It's only 30 pages, and it's not strictly a fencing manual. It's a manual on how to fence and how to ride a horse.
Right.
And how to fight on horseback.
Right.
But the really weird thing is it's actually written as a poem.
Huh.
It's a humanist poem. So he's like referencing Vulcan and Aphrodite and Venus, or Venus and Aphrodite are the same. Cupid. That's the other one. He's referring to them while he refers to certain techniques.
Right.
And some of it is very, very clear. You can read it nicely. So there's a Ralph Cramden reference in 1577 as he, gives the actual original Italian name for a rodopio, which is a sobaccio.
Okay.
And he says, it comes from your left parts to his right side and straight to the moon. The Alice was an edition of the 50s, apparently. But then there's other times where, to fit the meter, they'll take the suffix off the end of the verbs, which tells you, you know, who the verb refers to.
Oh.
And they'll just assume that you know.
Oh, good. Oh, God.
So it's that one's being a bit obtuse, and I want to get it translated, of course, in my copious spare time,
yeah,
and then stand it on its feet and see what's going on.
Right.
So that would be an example. There are lots of things I'd like to get to. There's just only so much time in the day.
Right. So that singularity comes and you can just put your brain in a robot body and translate manuals all day. You're good? You're going to go for it?
Let's put it this way. If I don't get a professorship after I get a PhD,
yeah,
I certainly won't have time to get bored. Let's put it that way. And if I do get the professorship, I certainly won't have time to get bored when I retire.
Right. I wonder how open universities would be to an alternative take on teaching if you get that professorship and you could, you know, you could bring swords to class and teach fencing right in the midst of class.
Well, actually my dissertation advisor has me come and do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He has me come and do, he teaches, of course, early modern and medieval history, so he has me come in with all the swords and talk about things and
yeah,
has me lecturing on that topic. But, for instance, I've already sat down and kind of pictured in my head, it's like, well, I could do a methodology course on medieval research by looking at hermeneutics, by looking at the different editions of Fiori and how they wrestle, or the different approaches that authors take to Ott the Jew in the German tradition, right? And you can study the way that one manuscript source differs from another in all sorts of different ways, and how they can make errors
right
in the game of telephone that it is to copy a manual to the next one, to the next one, to the next one.
Right.
So...
Now, yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No.
Oh, so in your discovery of these manuals, are you archiving them, like via, like, are you scanning these documents, or, like, is there, like, some sort of record of it, or?
Yes. And it comes in a couple of forms. So I have my little camera rig that I walk into the libraries and the archives with. And if you're lucky, they're a library that, no, come on in, photograph. Although it's not quite that easy in Italy, you have to fill out a form to get into the library.
Okay.
That includes, you know, your birthday, where you were born, your passport number, and quite often you'll have to hand over your passport with that form in order to get into the library.
Oh, jeez.
Then you have to find the books.
Right.
And then you have to fill out a form for each book to get the book. They don't let you into the stacks, so you can't do the researching that way. So then you submit that form, and if you're lucky, they have carbon paper, so sometimes you have to submit that form in triplicate.
This is very, like Terry Brooksian.
It's Brazil, and then of course you get the book and it's like, oh, this is delightful. I want to take pictures of it. Well, guess what? Another form. So, Spedioli I found in Milan, and it was a nice, easy process. It was just they made me fill out one form for all the things I took pictures of, and it was free. But stuff like the Museo Corée in Venice. This is my contribution to the HEMA world knowledge. I had them scan for me a copy of Gayani's 1619 fencing manual. And I thought I was being a real clever guy. And I paid 75 euros from it. Guess what they do the next day? Up on Google Books. So you're welcome, everyone. So yeah, I have all these things in picture format. So I found 1614 edition of Quintio. I found a 1609 manual on knighthood and the use of the arme blanche. So presumably the sword.
Right.
And so, yeah, I found a lot of these little weird books. And I even found a small sword manual from the late 18th century, which has not seen the light of day in the West, which is Vandoni's Elements of the Fence.
Oh, wow.
From 1778, I think.
So you really do have your translation work cut out for you?
Oh, yeah, I got no end of things.
Yeah. Have you submitted any of these things off to the hive mind to see what others make of them yet?
No. I'm being greedy that way.
Okay.
I found them.
Yeah.
I will take credit for them.
Fair
but I'm trying to get through them as you know, but I have so many other things to translate
sure.
first. Right. So, Spedioli, I've got that transcribed. I've started the translation. I'm going to ask a professor at the University of Toronto who may be able to help me get through the formalities of Italian poetry in the 16th century. And then I have some folks at AIMA who are willing to stand it up and excuse me, see how it works.
Right. AIM right. as the Academy of European Medieval Martial Arts. Yeah. So they're kind of bug testing it.
Well, I will bug test it with individual members who have been working with the Bolognese stuff, which right. they've been working on one of the manuals from 1572. This one's from 1577, helping fill in that blank area between 1575 and 1606, right. which we've had like Ghistliero, and I don't think anything else really. Cavalcabo, but it's still a 30-year period with only two manuals.
Right.
This is the third to go in that period. So,
one of the things that at least I hear a lot is, you know, there's only so many ways to swing a sword. There's only so many ways to move your body. Have you found in studying this many manuals and doing this many translations that there is a lot of similarity, or is there a lot of differences that, you know, you don't see on the surface?
It depends on how much of an argument with Tom Leone you want me to get into. Tom argues that all Italian fencing manuals are describing the exact same thing.
Right.
Which I would argue, then, why print another one? I mean, you could argue that, yes, they were trying to get patronage through the court system, but all of them are different. Tom looks at Agrippa as being this revolution, and everything was new with Agrippa. But Agrippa's, you know, got several different revolutions going on. First off, in his four basic guards that he uses that go around the cone in front of the fencer. Second is the numeric system of naming them, prim, secon, terz, quarta. The next one is the use of naked figures. The next one is the idea of using a picture and a text describing exactly what's in the picture.
Right.
Right? He's also the first Italian manual to use copper plates. So there's a complete destruction of the idea of the image in Italian fencing manuals with the advent of printing in 1509.
Right.
Pictures disappear, and they only slowly come back in 1536. And Marazzo's pictures are limited because they're woodcuts. Agrippa's the first one to use copper plates and actually have combative action described by what's going on. Marazzo has some of the wrestling in the back that way, but he can't do the sword play because he can't get the detail in the plates.
Right, right.
So when we look at, say, what Giganti chose to use the naked figures, but he decided to not use the four guards of Agrippa. He decided to not use the numeric naming system of the guards. He decided to revise the system Agrippa used of picture, text, and actually improved on it, actually made a curriculum. He's the first master that lays it out. This is the first thing you need to learn. This is the next thing you need to learn. This is the next thing you need to learn. Capofero chose the numeric system, chose the naked figures, and I would argue did not choose the guards out of Agrippa. So I don't think you can say it's that easy.
Right.
And while the actions can be very similar, and the human body can only move in certain ways, the theory and the taxonomy and the ways people try to break down that knowledge will vary greatly. And that will be the change, and that's kind of the mystery of it.
Yeah, right. Would you say it's similar to, like, wrestling, how every culture has a system of wrestling? And for the most part, there's a lot of similarities, but I guess
No, I get what you're meaning.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily the best judge of that, because I actually have no Eastern martial arts training whatsoever.
Right.
I'm strictly Western martial arts.
Okay.
So, yeah, there are similarities between the wrestling systems that are used by Fiore and the certain ones used by Ott the Jew. And there are problems with Fiore's system, which he doesn't answer. He assumes you know. And people have chosen different ways to interpret the way it starts. I actually like look to Ott the Jew to figure out a different way of interpreting Fiore's initial wrestling plays. I haven't really, you know, been too aggressive in getting those around yet because I'm still kind of workshopping them myself.
Right.
But yeah, there are certain ways in which they're similar, but a lot of ways in which they're different, and you got to respect both.
Right. Okay. I'm out of questions. My brain's swimming with stuff now.
Is this the time for the Jeopardy theme?
Yeah, this is probably about the time. I don't know, do you have anything else that you want to say desperately to...
Everybody play with swords more and practice a lot.
Okay. Wise words. Do you have any plugs for your home base?
I've just started the home base, and it's the first time I've kind of landed anywhere that's kind of one of my own ships that way.
Nice.
But Scuola della Scherma Storica, we're out of Toronto, we're in week 4, so a lot of optimism, a lot of hope, and Not many practices so far. But I'll take my own advice and practice more.
Hey. So we'll definitely have a link in the show notes there, and be sure to visit the site.
And that's all I got.
Yeah.
You assume that we have a website already?
Well, when we do, we'll get into it.
Yeah, we'll put a link up. Anytime you furnish us with a link,
we'll make sure it's there.
Very good.
All right.
Thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot, guys.